Welcome to The Vampire Squid, a podcast about increasing transparency and education in finance. This is your host, Alan Lee, and welcome to episode 40 of The Vampire Squid. I can't believe we already made it to episode 40, and I hope everyone's also having a great long weekend. So for this 40th episode, I had to do something special, and today we're going to have on Aswath Damodaran, and he is the go-to guru for valuation. He's been teaching at NYU for the last 30 years. His work has been cited numerous times. He has one of the most popular finance blogs. He teaches training for some of the largest investment banks, and I would say most people in finance know of Aswath, and he's very highly respected, and he has been kind enough to come onto the podcast and share his thoughts. And this was one of the most interesting interviews that I have conducted. It challenged a lot of my prior beliefs in finance, and it is jam-packed. We talk about things from how valuation is neither an art nor a science. We talk about how even Warren Buffett can be hypocritical. And these are just some of the topics that we'll address in this entire episode, but as always, if you guys have any questions, comments, suggestions, please feel free to reach out to me at Alan, A-L-A-N, at thevampiresquid.com. You can always go to my Facebook page, facebook.com/thevampiresquid. So without further ado, please welcome Aswath Damodaran. So welcome to The Vampire Squid. I have on a very special guest today with me, Aswath Damodaran, who has been a professor at NYU teaching valuation and finance, which I'm sure most all of you know. So Aswath, thanks so much for coming onto the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So Aswath, if you wouldn't mind just maybe providing a brief background on your history so that our listeners get a better understanding of how you got interested in finance and your experiences.
Okay, I grew up in India. I came to get my MBA at UCLA in the late 1970s, expecting to go on to do what MBAs did. I found myself as a TA in the second year of my MBA program, trying to make some money to cover tuition. Found that I loved teaching so much that I knew that was what I was going to do for the rest of my life. So I'm actually not a finance person. I'm a teacher who happens to teach finance. So I went on to get my PhD at UCLA and taught a couple of years at Berkeley and then came to NYU in 1986. So I've been teaching corporate finance and valuation here since 1986. The valuation class I constructed in 1986 was actually the first full semester valuation class ever offered anywhere in the world. So it was actually cut and paste because there wasn't enough stuff in valuation to actually fill a whole class. So from that, it's now 31 years and 52 semesters of valuation later. So, it's kind of grown as I've learned almost everything I know about valuation. I've learned in the course of teaching this class. So it is actually in the process of teaching that I've kind of learned to think about valuation.
Mm-hmm. And just going back to the beginning, what sort of sparked the interest in finance, or is that something that just came naturally? What was the initial interest?
I mean, I think everybody's interested in money. I mean, they say there are three things that you can talk about that attract attention: sex, stock, and salvation. So, it's one of the three S's. So I don't think there's anybody who's going to tell you I'm not interested in money. Even the Dalai Lama probably is interested in money, just in a different way. So finance is just a study of money. So it's in the process, it's psychology, it's storytelling, it's markets, it's everything is tied up in it.
Mm-hmm. And, as you've been teaching valuation and, your interactions with students, what do you find that students necessarily have the most difficulty with when they're learning about finance, off the start, or, any misconceptions they have about finance?
I think people think of finance they think of it as an extension of accounting. So they think it's all about numbers all the time, and it's not. It's really much, much, much more than just accounting. It's as I said, everything you do is finance.
Mm-hmm.
See, Super Bowl, it's a gigantic financial exercise. It's one of the biggest money-driven events in the world. So, you know, you might think you're watching a football game, but you're really watching money at play. You watch Lady Gaga do her halftime show, that's money, that's finance right there. So in a sense, there's a finance component to almost everything you see, whether it's legislation, whether it's songs, whether it's movies, whether it's sporting events. Underlying all the fun and the excitement, there's money driving. It's the lubricant that keeps this process going. So when people come in, they expect a lot of number crunching, but in a sense, I surprise them. I talk about businesses. I talk about stories. I talk about connecting stories to numbers. And that's really what I think they find surprising, because they thought they would come in, to them, the vision of finance is banking lamps and green eye shades and, you know, checking ledger sheets. It's not that.
And in terms of, you know, when you mentioned the Super Bowl or Lady Gaga, are you speaking more to the point of this event is to make money at the very core?
No, without the money, there would be no event. Let's face it, without the money, there is no event. So it's without the money, there is no TV carrying it. There's no Tom Brady. There's no Bill. It'll be just a football game played by two teams on a field and there'll be nobody watching. So it's the money that actually greases the skids for this to become the largest sporting event in the world. Same thing's true for the World Cup, or if you're a cricket fan, all the IPL matches in India. Ultimately, without the money, these things will implode. And for some people, that's bad because they want this to be a pure sporting event. But let's face it, once you're talking about professional sports and there's money involved, you might not like it, but that the money is going to talk, and the louder it talks, the more it's going to change the game.
Interesting. It's something that just comes off to the top of my head. You know, what do you think about back in the day when it was more of a barter system and things weren't necessarily driven from a monetary cash perspective?
Oh, it's monetary. It's still cash. Basically, if you don't have cash, it's still economics.
Uh-huh.
Right? When you barter two of your parts for one of my axes, you are internally making a judgment about what the value of those two parts is. So taking money out of the system doesn't make finance go away. It just makes it more complicated because now you got to find somebody who wants what you have and who has something you need. That's the problem. Trading in kind is, you know, you're going to have more difficulty actually finding a trade to make because you don't have that common ingredient of converting to cash. So cash is just a convenience. It allows you to trade with people who don't like what you have. But by converting into cash in the middle, you basically allow this process to become much smoother. And remember, there's always been some version of cash, right? It could have been shells. So don't assume that there was nothing. So this need for having a common currency probably goes back thousands and thousands and thousands of years. That common currency initially might have been shells. It might have been gold, but it's as old as time. And I'm sure the cavemen probably discovered very quickly that in-kind trade doesn't work very well, that you need to convert it into, you know, something more substantial.
Mm-hmm. I guess the counter question would be, do you think there's anything out there that isn't driven by money or by valuation?
Oh, we're human beings. There's an altruistic component that is always a function of it. But, you know, so there's an entire set of actions we take which have nothing to do with money. But, and I fully accept that. But that's, I think, it's a much smaller part of the world than the money part, much as the people who believe that things should be driven by ideals and altruism might want otherwise. Without the money, there can be no altruism. I mean, let's face it, Bill Gates has been able to give away $5 billion from his foundation precisely because Microsoft was a money machine that he built. So when people look down their nose at money, they forget that without the money, the altruism would not be there, that we were all basically toiling for nothing, then we can't really afford to be altruistic. The cavemen were not a very altruistic group because they had to survive. It's the fact that people are able to make money in their businesses that allows them to be generous with that money. So I'm not denying that there's a human component of altruism, but that altruism needs something on the other side to fund it. And that funding comes from starting businesses, being successful in life, and then being altruistic. If you're not successful, it's very difficult if you go out and be altruistic. We have nothing to give away.
Yeah. And, you know, with the general negative perception of those in the finance industry and, you know, based on what you just said, given that most things or most all things are driven by finances, valuation, How do you sort of help people bridge that gap?
See, that's not my job. I don't care what people think about other groups of people. I mean, let's face it, there aren't too many groups of people who are alike.
Mm-hmm.
You don't like politicians, you don't like bankers, you don't like accountants, you don't like lawyers. Who do you like? You know? You don't like sports players. So this is human nature. People will dislike entire groups of people. They'll assign them with all kinds of bad motives. I don't see the need for me to go out and try to defend them. That's between you and that group. Work it out, because it's not something that I can talk you out of. It comes from emotion, not rational explanation. So that's between you and that group. Work it out. I mean, it's not my job to make you feel better about any group out there.
Sure. And I guess going back to your goals, how have your goals started out when you first started teaching to what are your current goals or motives to continue teaching?
I don't have a goal. I mean, I'm a teacher. So I live this life of a semester. My job is for that semester making as much of a difference to the people in my class as I can. Beyond that, I mean, you know, I don't need a bigger goal. So I go semester to semester, it adds up. Life is incremental. The problem with all these people who have massive goals, I'm going to do this before I'm 50 or 60 or 70, is they miss life as it happens. To me, I enjoy every semester. I do the most I can every semester. And guess what? Over time, those incremental effects add up. So I've discovered that you don't need big goals. You need to kind of get down to earth and do the small things today, and the big things will take care of themselves.
Yeah, I really like that perspective. And I think with most people today, they usually set very large goals. But I do think it's very important to incrementally get better each and every semester in your case, or every day for others.
My job is learning, and learning never ends. You know, I start in the morning when I wake up. I read a new story, I learn. I see a cartoon, I learn. So I don't view this as there's no magic bullet which is going to make me a learned person one day. It's just I have to work on learning whatever I can every day. I'm not going to wait till I'm 50 to be able to spend the time to learn something. I have to do it as it comes to me. So I think that we have to take the incremental approach. Like, same thing with the world's problems. If you try to solve the world's problems in one go, you're going to fall flat on your face.
Mm-hmm.
You see a problem and you think you can make it better. Make that incremental change. Talk to that one person, even if you can change one person's life. That's one more than you did a few minutes ago. So keep it incremental. And as I said, the big stuff takes care of itself.
With valuation, people always seem to describe it as both a art and a science. Do you have any thoughts on whether it's weighted heavily towards the art side or the science side?
It's neither. It's a craft.
Huh.
I think of it like cooking. You learn cooking by doing. You learn valuation by doing. It's neither an art nor a science. People who call it an art basically want a license to do whatever they can, because it's an art. I can do whatever I want. I'm a Picasso. The people who call it a science want to call it a science because they want to run it with the equations that they've said are the equations that should drive everything. It's neither an art nor a science. It's not an art because you can teach it. It's not a science because you get the inputs right. You're not guaranteed that the output's going to be right. It's a craft. You learn by doing. And if you want to really master valuation, value a company and then value another one and keep valuing companies. Each time you value a company, you will learn something new about valuation.
Interesting. And with the stock market and with how companies are valued in the stock market, there's a lot of ways to value companies. And sometimes you get something called a fair value, but the fair value may not be represented in the stock market. What do you think about that?
Markets don't value companies. They price them. It's demand and supply. So don't try to create too much of a rationalization of what you see out there. It's demand and supply. Demand and supply can be driven by fundamentals.
Mm-hmm.
They can also be driven by mood. They can be driven by momentum. That's the way it is. It's a feature, not a bug of markets. That's the way markets have always worked. They price things. They do an amazing job of pricing things, but they sometimes screw up. So when you value companies, you're A, saying markets can make mistakes, and B, you're saying that they will correct their mistakes. Both are assumptions. I call investing faith. I mean, to invest, you need faith. Faith that you can value companies and faith that the market will correct its mistakes. There's no guarantee that either will happen. And most people who claim to be investors have no faith. They have no faith either in their own valuations, or they lose faith that the market will correct its mistakes. So most people who claim to be investors are nothing of the sort. They're traders. Traders in the sense that their objective is to buy at a low price and sell at a high price. Who cares why the price went up? It doesn't matter. If it went up 50%, it went up 50%. So most people who call themselves investors trade on the market. There's nothing wrong with it. There's no reason to be, you know, to feel badly about it. It is the nature of the process. If you have no faith, that's what you will end up doing. And, you know, and that's what most people end up doing.
Okay. And it seems like the way you're describing it, there has to be, maybe a long bias, because in the short term, you know, people can profit off of movements in the stock market. Would you say that most people that value?
Yeah, most people, if you call yourself an investor, you probably need time as your ally, right? Because to get the market to correct its mistakes, you need time. But the problem is, if you ask me how long, I can't answer, because there's no guarantee that even if you held for 10 years, that a mistake will get corrected. That's why I call it faith. The essence of faith is I can't offer you proof. And you have to be willing to kind of jump into the pool without that proof that you're going to be able to get out of the pool. And that's tough for most people. Most people don't have that faith. They can talk a good game, but they can't do it. They can't actually be investors. They can tell you they have long-term horizons. But I tell people, I'm not going to listen to what you say. I'm going to look at what you do. And I look at these portfolio managers who tell me they have long-term horizons. And I look at the average period they hold their stocks in 6 months. And your actions speak louder than words. And your actions are telling me your time horizon is not 10 years. It's not 5 years. It's 6 months. So again, it's easy to talk the long game. It's much more difficult to play the long game. And even over the long term, if you ask me, can you guarantee me as an investor I'll make more money than those traders who speculate on prices? I cannot. There's no justice in this world. You could do everything right. You could be a long-term investor. You can take care of fundamentals and do valuation. And at the age of 85, your neighbor who's been trading every day, is a day trader, has made 10 times more money than you did. And you have to be okay with that. If you're not okay with that, don't invest, because you're going to get bitter really fast. You're going to get bitter that other people who don't seem to be doing their homework are making a lot of money and you're not, and you're doing all the right things. And that's a recipe for disaster in investing, because then you double down, double up. You try to take the market. You could try to show the market who's boss. And guess what? Anybody tries to show the market who's boss ends up being bossed by the market. The market doesn't take easily. You could be Warren Buffett and you try to show the market up, the market will show you up.
Yeah, that reminds me of the saying where the stock market can be irrational longer than you can be rational.
The stock market can be irrational longer than you can be solvent.
Solvent, okay.
That was Lord Keynes. He said, you know, you can, and basically what he was saying is you can guess right, but by the time the market corrects its mistakes, you could have ended up in bankruptcy court.
Got it. Who are the investors that you admire?
I think this is one of the mistakes we make in investing. We fall into hero worship. There are some aspects of every investor that I admire. I admire Bill Ackman's persistence. I admire Carl Icahn's megaphone when he gets an investment. I admire Warren Buffett's consistency. But they're all human. There are things that Warren Buffett does that I don't love. There are things that Bill Ackman does that I don't agree with. There are things that Carl Icahn says that I think are incredibly stupid. Now, it doesn't mean that I cannot admire the parts of what they do. Ultimately, to be a good investor, you got to find what works for you, not what works for Warren Buffett or Peter Lynch. And I think that's my advice to investors. Know yourself, because to me, that is the key to being a successful investor, is to learn what makes you tick, what makes you uncomfortable, what makes you comfortable, and find an investment philosophy that fits you, not fits your neighbor. And that's why I see all these books in bookstores on how to become a great investor, how to invest like Warren Buffett. It's the most useless waste of time trying to be somebody else. I mean, if Warren Buffett was 35 years old reading the books on how to be like Warren Buffett, he couldn't be Warren Buffett today. His success came from a different age, and Every investor who's been successful will tell you, if he's honest, that luck played a significant role in their success. That without that being at the right place at the right moment hit, they would never have become as successful as they were. And I think, so that's, I think, part of the problem with trying to overread into success. We assume that success comes from skill, but success can come as often from luck as it does from skill. So take what you admire from other investors, but find your own pathway, because ultimately that's how you become a successful investor.
That's very helpful. And just curious, you know, I can definitely think of some things that I don't necessarily admire about Bill Ackman or Carl Icahn, but I'm curious what your thoughts were on what you don't admire about Warren Buffett.
Well, Warren Buffett is very much a manager's best friend. He talks a good corporate governance game, how shareholders need to be listened to. But I think in the companies he's an investor, he's a manager's best friend. For the last 15 years, he's played the inside game, which is much of his money has come from special deals he's made to invest in these companies, whether it's Goldman Sachs or Bank of America. And you can see why the companies did it. They want to buy his credibility, and he essentially sold it to them by demanding a discount on their prices. So what made Warren Buffett so incredibly successful in the 60s and 70s, and this is what I admire about him, is he knows his strong points and he knows his weak points. His strong points is he's very good at assessing value at mature companies, mature cash, mature and profitable businesses, the Coca-Cola's of the world, the American Express's, the Washington Post. He's not very good with growth companies. And he knows and most investors are not good about sensing what their weak spots are. Warren Buffett knows his weak spots. He stays away from them. That's the part about Warren Buffett I admire. But he's hypocritical about lots of things, and including corporate governance and taxes. I mean, he talks a good game for everybody else, but you look at his actions, he's actually violated many of the things he says the rest of us should be doing. So I know I don't put Warren on a pedestal like some people do. He's a great investor. He's a phenomenally consistent investor, but at the same time, he's a human being. He's got his blind spots too. The only thing about him is he knows what his blind spots are, and he tries to steer away from losing too much money in those blind spots.
Thanks so much for listening to part one of the interview with Oswath. For next week, we're going to finish up the conversation and dive a little bit deeper into his background, talk about technology stock, different growth phases, and much more. So thanks so much for listening, and I'll see you guys next week. Ciao.